This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
According to human rights organizations, between April 2015 and May 2017, at least 1,200 people were killed, 900 disappeared forcefully, and more than 10,000 people were illegally detained amid Burundi's political unrest.
That's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi. Details next. Also, the U.S. military announced yesterday that it carried out an airstrike and killed several al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. And thousands of patients in Uganda are feeling the pinch of the doctor's strike that began 4 days ago. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Burundi's government says it will not cooperate with the International Criminal Court over its plan to investigate alleged human rights abuses in the country. The East African nation recently withdrew from the ICC charter, but the court argues the pullout does not affect its jurisdiction over crimes committed earlier. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
Speaking to reporters in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, Justice Minister Aime Laurentien says the ICC has no right to conduct an investigation in her country.
Burundi not being state party to the ICC statute is not concerned with the so-called decision of that court. The government of Burundi reject that decision and reiterate its firm determination that it will not cooperate with International Criminal Court or any other fraudulent manipulation intending facilitate extend the mandate of the ICC on the territory of Burundi.
The government response comes a day after three judges at the ICC authorized the prosecutor to open an investigation into alleged human rights abuses committed inside and outside of Burundi between April 2015 and October 2017. Burundi became a member of the Rome Statute, the treaty that established the ICC in 2004. The country announced a plan to withdraw from the statute in October 2016, and the notification took effect last month. Burundi accused the court of targeting African countries. Vital Nshimana heads Burundi's Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society. He says pulling out of the ICC won't save those behind crimes against civilians.
Now it is very well informed that it cannot escape justice because victims are crying for justice, and today no crime cannot go unpunished in the modern world.
According to human rights organizations, between April 2015 and May 2017, at least 1,200 people were killed, 900 disappeared forcefully, and more than 10,000 people were illegally detained amid Burundi's political unrest. Security forces and the ruling party youth wing, better known as Imbonerakure, have been accused of being behind much of the killings of civilians and political opponents. Laurentien says her country has the capacity to prosecute those behind the human rights violations.
Burundi has efficient and able institutional and legal mechanisms to conduct investigations and to take it before justice authors of any kind of crimes committed in its territory without discrimination, fear or favor.
Some rights groups, however, doubt that Burundi's judiciary can give justice to the victims of political violence. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In related news, the UN General Assembly and Security Council members yesterday awarded seats for 4 out of 5 judges to serve in the International Criminal Court. After five rounds of voting, Nawaf Salam of Lebanon, the current leader of the court, Roni Abraham of France, his vice president, Abdul Kawi Ahmed Yusuf of Somalia, and Antonio Augusto Cancado Trinidad of Brazil seem to have made it. The ICC has 15 members, and a third of them are up for re-election every 3 years. In 2014, it took seven rounds in the General Assembly and four in the Security Council to elect five judges. Based in The Hague, the ICC is tasked with prosecuting those responsible for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity when national courts are unwilling or unable. The U.S. military says it has carried out an airstrike that killed several al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. Pentagon spokesman Audricia Harris told VOA the attack took place early yesterday in the Bay region in the center of the country, about 160 kilometers west of Mogadishu. According to the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, the strike occurred about 3 p.m. in Somalia and was coordinated with the Somali government. U.S. forces will continue to use all authorized and appropriate measures to protect Americans and to disable terrorist threats, Africa Command said. The strike comes less than a week after U.S. airstrikes targeted Islamic State fighters in the country's north. Thousands of patients in Uganda are left untreated because of the doctor strike that began on Monday. Doctors in government health centers have vowed to stay away from work until the government addresses their grievances. The medics want the government to improve their salaries and working environment. VOA's Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Ugandan patients are stranded at different health facilities across the country as the doctors' strike that started on Monday continues. Medical workers under their umbrella body, Uganda Medical Association, went on strike protesting their low pay and poor working environment. The medics want an improvement in their living conditions, including an increase in their pay and duty allowances. They also want a review of the supply chain and management of medicines, vaccines and medical supplies. The medics are pushing for a pay rise of nearly $2,000 per month. Currently, a senior consultant doctor earns about $1,000 each month, while a medical officer earns about $500. Besides increased salaries, the medics also want government to provide them with housing and vehicles. Pauline Biachika is the vice president, Uganda Medical Association.
We are not able to survive in Uganda today. It's quite difficult. The interns are crying out. They're saying we are sleeping in slums. Some doctors have given testimonies of where a doctor has had to use razor blades to carry out a cesarean section because they did not have the necessary equipment. There are places where equipment has been put in place, but there's no human resource. So the interns, the doctors, the workers in the health facilities are saying government has done something, but it's not enough. And when we say it's not enough, government says, yes, we are negotiating, but they're not seeing, you know, the breakthrough of the negotiation.
Patients and their caretakers at several government-owned health centers have nowhere else to go for medical attention, as they cannot afford treatment in private health centers. Some patients have given up on seeing the medics and have decided to return home. John Kakembo, who had taken a relative to Mulago Referral Hospital, talks about the situation he found there.
I found when there is many patients, some of them are outside, some others are inside, they were on the reception there. And the health workers, they have been there, standing there, but when they are not working.
It was a similar situation at Busia Health Center in eastern Uganda. Isaac Odiambo went there one morning to pick up his monthly medications. He says he cannot count how many patients died due to lack of medical attention during the 5 hours he was at the facility.
by 7:30 I was here, and I've witnessed some deaths. So brought people in critical conditions, nobody's there to attend to them.
Ugandans like Gordon Semakula, who is a concerned member of the public, are afraid if the strike goes on, many more deaths are likely to occur.
First and foremost, we have a few health workers, and those who are there, they are now on a strike. That means our people are going to die.
At the once busy Naguru Health Center in Kampala, a medic who preferred anonymity confirmed that they are only handling emergencies such as accidents and births.
As for us, we only admit mothers who are going to deliver, and even catering some emergencies. Those who were not bad off, we told them that today you can go to any other place, because for us, we are having problems.
Government has called on the medics to call off their strike, promising that they are handling the enhancement of their salaries together with other civil servants. David Bahati is Uganda's state minister for planning.
We are in the process of reviewing all salaries of civil servants, and it is important that everybody understand that, one, we are going to focus on the lower cadres of the civil service first. Second, we are giving priority to all scientists. The process is moving up to end of November, and we think that once this is done, we'll be able to solve this problem once and for all.
However, the medics say they are tired of promises and will not reconsider their position until a tangible solution is found. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi's government says it will not cooperate with the International Criminal Court over its plan to investigate alleged human rights abuses in the country. The U.S. military announced yesterday that it carried on an airstrike and killed several Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia. And thousands of patients in Uganda are feeling the pinch of the doctor's strike that began on Monday. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. This week, Ivory Coast signed a nearly $525 million compact grant with the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation. The money will be spent over 5 years to spur economic growth in the West African country and promote regional stability and security. VOA's correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
The grant is designed to support growth and private investment by building up workers' skills and reducing transportation costs. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara told VOA he welcomed the move.
The money in education will be used to build classrooms to improve the skills of the young people, because youth employment is an objective of the government. And on the transport side, it will be investment in the transport of Abidjan, because Abidjan is a city of 6 million people. It's congested, and so we need to find ways to make sure that we improve the fluidity of movement in Abidjan.
In a signing ceremony at the U.S. State Department, Jonathan Nash, the Millennium Challenge Corporation's acting CEO, said a lack of training for workers has constrained the Ivorian economy.
We'll focus on improving basic literacy and numeracy skills in secondary education, complemented by an innovative technical and vocational training model that is closely linked with the actual needs of the private sector.
MCC was established by former President George W. Bush and over the years has benefited from bipartisan support. The agency works with developing countries that have committed to good governance and economic freedom, among other benchmarks. Only 7 years ago, Ivory Coast endured a deep political crisis when then-President Laurent Gbagbo was forcibly removed from office after refusing to accept the result of presidential elections won by Alassane Ouattara. But since 2012, the country has had one of Africa's fastest-growing economies, with annual GDP growth of about 9%. Ouattara said discipline is key to maintaining this kind of growth.
Good macroeconomic policies, solid macroeconomic framework that will attract foreign investment. And if you have good governance where the money is used in the priority sectors, obviously this leads to growth.
At Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies, President Ouattara said that as the world's top cocoa and raw cashew nut exporter, his country needs to be more aggressive on the processing side.
We produce 40% of the world cocoa, and yet we only process about 30%. We're the first world producer of cashew nuts. There again, we process less than 10%.
The president said another challenge is the fight against terrorism. He recalled the deadly attack last year in the town of Grand Bassam and pleaded for more coordination and support for his country and the newly established G5 Sahel counterterrorism group. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
African contemporary art and design is being showcased in the French capital Paris this weekend with a three-day fair. It is among a number of African artistic events taking place in France. This year, Lisa Bright attended the opening of the second edition of Also Known as Africa, the first of its kind in Paris, and has this report.
The richness and diversity of African creativity is packed into the massive Carreau du Temple in central Paris. This building once served as a food market in the 19th century. The goods have changed. The crowds today are admiring cutting-edge sculptures, paintings, and photography, like the works of Januario Jano, an Angolan artist who splits his time between London, Lisbon, and Luanda.
As an artist, I come more for the experience and support the gallery. Actually, I don't like to be on those places. I like to be in my studio and, you know, talk to my work and do my things. The whole experience is new for me. And I'm trying just to understand what's going on, because this relationship between the audience, the collectors, you know, everybody else, the media and everything, I think is not different than other events like fashion shows and stuff. So I'm trying to enjoy it.
Gallery owner Sonia Ribeiro, who's displaying Jano's work, says Angola's art scene is recent and still struggling, especially with the country's financial crisis.
Arts and culture, it's something we need to help to develop, you know, the awareness and the projects and the spaces, but mainly to bring the artists, you know, to be more in a global spectrum.
38 galleries from 19 African and European countries are present at the also known as Africa Fair, or ACA. Photographer David Ozoshuku is Austrian but has Nigerian roots. He recently shot a global campaign for sportswear giant Nike that featured British singer FKA Twigs.
It's super exciting. I mean, it's a huge, huge space. There are some other artists that I'm very excited about. Apart from that, I'm just like also super glad to see my own work in print, which I don't do very often. Yeah, and the response from people has been amazing.
Roughly 15,000 people attended last year's first edition of ACA. Parisian Grace Lubasu, whose family comes from Congo Brazzaville, is back for more.
Really enjoying myself to see a lot of different things here. I don't think you need to be originally or connected by Africa to understand the arts here. And they try to be democratized everywhere, to not be just in Africa.
The show also features public discussions, documentaries, and performances. The theme, at a time when a number of African countries are caught up in conflicts, is healing. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Harvard University is hosting a panel today to discuss challenges facing the democratic transition into Tunisia. The university invited four former Tunisian prime ministers to assess the political and economic situation in the emerging North African democracy. Sara Yerkes is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. She tells VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi that poor economic prospects and security concerns are behind the intense public dissatisfaction in Tunisia, and she expresses concerns about backsliding in the democratic transition.
The primary explanation is that the demands of the revolution have not been met. The economy is worse off today than it was in 2010, particularly for young people who have extremely high levels of unemployment. And Tunisia has experienced several serious security incidents, terrorist attacks. And while that situation is mostly under control, there's still a sense of insecurity among the public. So the public, frankly, just don't trust the government to deliver the economic and security needs that they fought for during the revolution.
Sarah, you expressed your concern over three moves taken by the Tunisian government lately, signaling a major backsliding in the democratic development. What are they?
The first is a cabinet reshuffle in which we're now seeing some figures from the Ben Ali regime in the cabinet, including the Minister of Education, the Minister of Finance, who both held these positions under Ben Ali. The second is the passage of the Administrative Reconciliation Law, which provides amnesty for civil servants who are accused of corruption under Ben Ali. It sidesteps both the judicial system as a whole and the transitional justice process that has been tasked with carrying out investigations of corruption activities. And then third is the postponement of the municipal elections for the third time. They are supposed to take place now in March 25th, but we'll see if they actually happen. They've been postponed multiple times, and there's not a lot of faith amongst the public that these elections will take place then.
Well, you are seeing these as signaling a major backsliding in democratic transition.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that all of these are things that combined signal a shift backwards. To take any one of these, they're not in and of themselves a major red flag, but I think the fact that you're seeing a pattern of behavior, this idea that they're rolling back some of the democratic transition, some of the steps forward, such as this the Administrative Reconciliation Law, which again goes outside of the system, goes outside of the processes that have been agreed upon by the public and the government. The cabinet reshuffle, which removes some people who, without any ties to the former regime, and brings in people that are clearly, you know, from the Ben Ali era. These are signals that democracy is not the priority right now.
What role do you envision for the U.S. and the international community to ensure that the democratic transition in Tunisia does not get derailed?
Thing that I would suggest is for the West, the United States, and Europe to continue to pay attention to Tunisia. It's very easy for Americans, Europeans, to fall into the trap that Tunisia's doing fine, so we can just leave it alone. And I think this is not the right attitude to have. While Tunisia may be doing better than many of its neighbors, politically, economically, and security situation, it still needs attention. It needs good attention, and sometimes it needs bad attention in order to keep it on course. And the second thing I would point to is the assistance relationship, and where we've seen both the United States and Europe increase their assistance in economic and security assistance significantly since the revolution. There's been a little bit of a shift since the 2014 elections away from a focus on democracy building, on institution building. And again, I think this is a mistake. This transition is not yet complete, and I think it's incumbent on the West to do whatever it can to help.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a fellow at Carnegie's Middle East program. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.